Tara Lockery Grant here in for Ryan Tubridy. I have to say a big hello to the Lennox ladies from Scarries, who I met recently, and they made me promise and I did it. And much to David Coleman's amusement, who's sitting opposite me now, our resident clinical psychologist. So he's joined us in studio to deal with any parenting issues that you may be struggling with. So if you'd like some advice on how best to handle the problem that you have with your kids, get in touch. Call us on 1850 715 922 or drop us a text 51552 or email tubs at rte.ie. First, though, we have had some emails that have come in since the last time that David was here. David, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
With, how did you have a lovely bank holiday?
I did, yeah, very pleasant. Very good. Pleasant. I'm completely thrown being here on a Tuesday, but that's
yeah,
all right.
Yeah, that's all right. Well, we're happy to have you here. And we've had lots of emails in. The texts are coming in now as well to 51552. But an email here, David, I need help with my son. My partner and I are separated and are trying to co-parent our six-year-old. The problem is that my son always tries to pit us against each other. A lot of parents will understand that side of things, but it must be more difficult when you are separated. He's always saying, Daddy lets me stay up later, Daddy lets me eat sweets, Daddy, you know, all this usual thing. I was getting really annoyed with my ex-partner, but now I'm beginning to think that my son is just making it up. I don't know what to do.
Well, the key is actually to talk to her ex-partner. That's the easiest way to resolve the issue. And I mean, if they say that they're trying to co-parent, that means that they've obviously got some plan where they both want to be involved, both want to stay involved. And so that means actually that they have to talk to each other, particularly about things like the routines and the rhythms that they have in each of their own houses. And, you know, it's not that they have to be exactly the same, but they have to know what happens in the other house. And that way then their son can't wriggle around in the middle. You know, he'll realise that actually mum and dad do talk. They might live together, but they talk a lot, and they talk a lot about me, they talk a lot about what I'm doing, and so I'm just not going to get away with trying to, you know, kind of whatever he's doing, twisting things slightly or exaggerating or whatever it is that he might be doing. But definitely, you know, direct talking if she can at all, and even sometimes, you know, put it down in an email and send it off if you find that it's actually still too hard to say the words or to speak or to hear the other person's voice or whatever. But again, you know, I think the one thing that, you know, parents have to accept, particularly when they're separated, is that, you know, the other person is a person in their own right, so they're going to have their own views. They're not necessarily going to agree with what you want and how you want to raise your child. So, I mean, in many cases, even when parents are still together, that actually causes a lot of tension. There's an awful lot of conflict in families sometimes when parents really don't agree about, well, look, why are we putting so much pressure on them to do this? You know, why are we letting them do that? You know, whatever it might be. So, but the key always is to talk. The more you can talk, the easier it gets.
Because otherwise you end up doing that thing, you know, whether you're, even if when you are together, you end up doing that voice of, well, I'm going to talk later to Daddy about letting you watch that until later. Okay, Daddy. And then obviously it's time for chats. What do you think of that thing of family meetings? I mean, it does sound very austere and boring, but where the parents agree something, we're separated or co-parenting or in the house together, and you agree something and you come to a compromise, and then you want to communicate that to the children and they know you're coming at it together. So if they are able to move on from email and sit down together, is that something you think works?
Yeah, family meetings are great, although if they're much better when you can try and include your children before you actually decide. So by all means, have your own discussion, have your own plans, think of what it is that you want. So, you know, if you think about it in terms of a negotiation, then you have what you want as your ideal outcome. You know, what will you then accept? And then listen to your children. Now, in this case, you know, the parents are separated and the little lad, I think, is only six.
Yes.
So A, it's hard because they're separated. It's hard. I mean, you know, there's a good reason that they're separated, I'm sure. And part of that was probably because they actually found it too difficult to be together. So coming together for a family meeting could be difficult. But when you come together as parents and you know, you show the fact that you're very much together on an issue, that's very good. You know, that really helps. But yeah, at the same time, you don't want to just come in and say, here we are, joint dictators now, and here's the rule and here's how we say it's going to be enforced, and allow children no say in it. So if you're going to have family meetings, which are great, do include your kids in it, though. So don't have your full decision made. I mean, you can still decide what it is that you want at the end, but at least be genuinely open to hearing, what do your children have to say about it? What's their view? What's their perception? What's their preference? Yeah. And if you can incorporate what they want a little bit, well, then do. So don't come in necessarily with a closed mind. I mean, by all means, you know, have your ideas about what you want, but try and keep things a little bit open until you actually hear what it is your kids want. And that way the family meeting really feels like a genuine open discussion about the issue, and then you can make a joint decision as a family.
That's really good, as opposed to everybody being dictated to and walking off unhappy.
Yeah, which, you know, I mean, again, when kids are very small, as parents, you do tend tend to act the dictator and you do make all the decisions. But as they get older, you know, the more you can include them in the decision making, the better, because they learn a lot about decision making as well, which is a really important skill that they need.
Exactly. And you're offering them choices even as a toddler age, you know. Yeah, that's
limited
really good
choices.
Limited soother or bottle. Yeah. No, but it's there. It's there. And that's feeling of I have a choice in this. Maybe I've noticed recently.
Bed now or bed in 5 minutes.
That's it. No, but it really works. That whole idea of putting the tantrum doesn't happen so much. There's another query, and again, a six-year-old thinks it's hilarious to swear. He does it everywhere and I'm mortified by him. I've tried to help him stop and punished him, but he thinks it's hilarious. Help. I think every parent can relate to this.
Yeah, the worst thing you can do, well, not the worst thing, but it certainly won't help to punish him, because really what you're doing is you're making it into a very big issue. You're making it very clear that this is something that winds you up, that you get very intense about. You know, I wouldn't worry at all about your child swearing or cursing, because, you know, there's so much of it about, whether it be on the TV, whether it be amongst friends, whether it be amongst your peers, even as adults. You know, people curse freely now around children. So children pick it up from lots of different sources. But once they get the big reaction of either, you know, half the adults in the room sniggering and snorting, thinking it's funny and hilarious that this child is now coming out with the F word or the whatever. And then the other half thinking, oh my God, what are those parents like? That's disgraceful, you know, which is, I presume, where this mum falls in, that she feels that everybody's judging her because her son is cursing. I just leave him off. You're best off to ignore it and to say, look, when you're ready to talk nicely, then we'll continue the conversation.
Good. That's good. Yeah, I'm taking that advice on board at the moment. That is very good.
For yourself now, your husband.
Well,
to stop the cursing.
I'm saying nothing. Moving on. No, that is really good. And we've all been there. And it is that thing of if it happens. And also, especially when the child does it at a time when an adult may do it, when the curse is used at the people in the right time, people end up being quite shocked and that nervous giggle.
Absolutely. And there are so many situations that we find ourselves in as parents that actually, if we think about it, we've witnessed so many other parents in exactly the same situations that, you know, we really do have to question, why am I so mortified by it?
Yeah.
Because actually, you know, most parents looking on, you know, feel an awful lot of sympathy or empathy at the very least with your situation.
Yeah.
I mean, I find it myself even now, you know, my kids are all a bit older, but like I walk around supermarkets doing the shopping and I see kids absolutely having the biggest tantrum on the floor, you know, and I don't walk by and think, you know, I walk by and think, thank God that's not me. That's such a hard place to be.
But
in.
David,
I wouldn't like to be that man.
I think aren't enough of you out there doing that. Like we you get amazing reaction. I mean, my toddler is two, so I am cleaning floors at the moment, or she is, should I say, with her tantrum hitting the floor. So moving around, cleaning them as she goes. We've cleaned a lot of supermarket aisles, and you get that look straight away of sympathy and empathy from an awful lot of people. I have to say, all jokes aside, a lot of people. And then the odd dirty or the tut tut, and it's really disheartening and upsetting, isn't it, when that moment when that happens?
It is, but it is actually possible to brush that off, because that's really more about that person. And, you know, what it means is that they're a bit self-absorbed, they're very much caught up in their own thing, and they're just, you know, put out that they have to, you know, step over your child
that's
in the
right.
aisle. But, like, you know, how difficult is that?
Exactly,
you know? Wouldn't
you're
it be
right.
worse if you were the person having to try to pick up the child and sort them out and soothe them? You know?
Well, I'm going to take your words in my head the next time we're polishing the floor somewhere. My 9-year-old is obsessed with beating everybody else in the class. She's in a competitive way. She's unbelievably competitive, and she seems to enjoy when the other girls don't do as well as her. It's affecting her friendships with the other girls in the class. Is there anything I can do? That's a very good question.
I'm sure it is affecting her friendships. No, nobody likes, do they? Somebody who crows over their victories. But, you know, the one thing, at that age, 9, most children age 9 can't really cope with competition because they just can't bear to lose. Now, some obviously, like that girl there, you know, really wear their heart in their sleeve in that regard. And so, you know, they become uber competitive to try and ensure that they never have to suffer that disappointment. But really part of it actually will be when she doesn't do well, because that would be really quite helpful for her, as long as there are adults around her who can help her cope with that disappointment. Because in order to actually enjoy success, you need to be also able to cope with the disappointment and the distress of not succeeding. And, you know, I mean, life will throw so many curveballs your way that we're never going to succeed all of the time. And we need to be ready for that. And so actually, you know, that age between kind of 5 and 12 is a good age to learn about the disappointment of not winning. Because, you know, if you play a board game with a 9-year-old or certainly with a 7-year-old, you know, you'll find that they'll cheat to beat the band because they just can't bear to win. You know, every you play snakes and ladders with a 7-year-old, you know, every snake has suddenly changed its function. You know, no, the snakes go up.
Yeah.
I swear they do. You know,
yeah. It's so true, isn't it?
And that's simply because it's crushing for them when they lose. And so we need to just be really really empathetic with that. We just need to be really ready to understand that, yeah, it is really hard to lose. But actually, you know, when we can soothe children's disappointment, then we teach them to soothe themselves when they don't win. And that's a really good skill. So I think that's what this mom and dad need to do with this girl here is just, you know, let her lose a little bit. But also just keep talking to her. Keep talking to her about what the other children are, how they're reacting, so that she begins to notice, because she may not really even be aware that her competitiveness is actually causing some of her friends to get really annoyed or frustrated or upset with her. And so it's about bringing her awareness to that possibly.
That's very good. And also the thing of as well, sometimes when parents are playing with kids, they can become very, very competitive themselves. And the kids see that. And all of a sudden, Danny's little project, which was supposed to be for four-year-olds, ends up being a 40-year-old's masterpiece. Yeah. So yeah.
But you see, and I think sometimes when we do play games with children, you know, we either tend to fall into the, oh, we'll just let them win, because actually the stress of having them lose is too much. And so kids get this sense that they always win, which isn't real life. But otherwise, you know, sometimes when we make children lose, we do it a little bit punitively.
Yes, it's and they know
we,
it.
Yeah, and we, yeah. And we also almost kind of want to make them feel the pain that little bit more. So when we do win, we need to win generously.
Exactly.
And to let them know that, yeah, you're not always going to win, but actually I know it's really hard. You look really upset. But I bet you the next time you play the game, you'll probably do much better.
Yeah.
You know, and then maybe the next time do let them win, so that it's a bit of winning, a bit of losing.
Exactly. And they see it in you too. Another text in as well. My 9-year-old has been diagnosed with depression. He has a very high IQ. Nine. He has a very high IQ. Could this be a contributing factor, David?
Who knows what the contributing factors are? I mean, you know, for a 9-year-old to be diagnosed with depression, things must be pretty significant, pretty severe, because very few people will go out on a limb and actually diagnose children that young with depression, which is not to say that children that young don't have depression. They do. I could imagine that if he has a very high IQ, he probably feels quite different, or she. It doesn't say whether it's a boy or girl,
no.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
So he probably feels quite different. He may also feel entirely understimulated in school, and in which case school might be boring, and he might actually be getting himself into bother in school. He may feel that you know, he doesn't fit in with the rest of the boys and girls in his class. So some of it might be about actually finding stuff to stimulate him. So, you know, there are certainly things like the DCU, the Centre for Talented Youth in Ireland, CTYI. So you can go and inquire about that, because that might be something that will engage him and you know, grab his attention.
But
and,
Dave, do you know what with that? That, you know, and that is a great centre, but they cost, you know. So if somebody has a talented youth and they need extra stimulation because they are bright and they should also be catered for, is it not unfortunate then that they have to pay?
I didn't realise I had to pay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's very unfortunate, you know. I mean, God, you could say the same thing about so many things in Irish life. You know, it is such a shame that we have to pay for what should and could be certainly...
And what's needed. You
know, yeah, basic facilities for kids. But definitely, you know, intelligence, high intelligence could well be a factor that sets him apart, and that might be what's contributing, because maybe he feels like he doesn't fit in, and actually it might be about his social interaction that he's really struggling with, and that might be the kind of the source of the depression. But, you know, without any other information, it could be many other things as well. It could be stress in the family. There could be anything going on.
God, I'm really thinking of those parents that's very young. And, you know, if without any more information, it's difficult for you. But I hoped that helped there. I'd really appreciate some advice, David. My 5-month-old had an ear infection recently. And since then, she's hysterical at every nap and bedtime. She cannot get past 45 minutes sleep at nap time. Before the ear infection, she was a pretty good sleeper. Many thanks. I'm at my wit's end. That must be so difficult.
My God, yeah. What do you do with a 5-month-old? Because, you know, it's so difficult. One of the things that, you know, she may have had, she was experiencing a huge amount of pain, which, of course, she would be with an ear infection. And that was probably disruptive. And so maybe she's just fallen a little bit out of her habit of sleeping. But maybe change what you do in terms of the nap time. And instead of perhaps leaving her down to nap, actually have her with you. So cradle her in your arms. She's only 5 months old. You know, put her in the bed beside you to sleep at night, because again, you know, that kind of comfort, that kind of soothing actually helps children just to fall back asleep. Because, you know, lots of children, you know, even by their own sleep rhythm, sleep routine, will come to wakefulness during that REM period, the dreaming period. And for small babies, that is about anything between 30 and 45 minutes is when we start to dream. In adults, it's a bit longer, anything between an hour and 1.5 hours. So it may be that she's just coming to wakefulness and you know, wakes up and is startled or distressed, much as she might have been when she had the ear infection, and actually just needs somebody there to soothe her. And if she's in the bed beside you, you know, she just snuggles into you, or you just lean over to her. You can settle her much quicker. She gets back to sleep quickly. You get back to sleep more quickly. And actually the whole night, you know, goes quite smoothly. And that then is just a short term thing as well. It's not like I'm saying, you know, keep her in your bed forever, but it might be just a short term solution until she settles back into that feeling of kind of soothing and relaxation.
And David, I know we're running out of time, but last thing, we're 2 months into the new school year. You're hearing a lot of people talking about brand new junior infants bullying, little going on so young, you know. So what do you do about that? It's so young. These are 4 or 5 year olds happening in this. It's not in the schoolyard. What advice would you have for parents who are going through that?
Well, you see, the idea of bullying, you know, is quite a complex phenomenon. But one of the things that we know about bullying is that it has to be something that's ongoing and insidious. And, you know, a lot of small children don't realise the harm that they're causing when they, you know, are mean to somebody else, when they leave somebody else out, when they try to trip somebody else up. You know, they're doing it because, you know, they're just being 4 and 5 year olds. And so a lot of it is about the adults that are around. And so, you know, any school that sees that this is becoming an issue where kids seem to be mean to each other in the junior infant or senior infant classes really need to put in a sustained effort where they talk about that. So any circle time opportunity should be all about things like sharing, inclusivity, you know, not hurting people, what it's like to be hurt, getting children to talk about it so there's a real culture of openness that people, you know, because sometimes, you know, children get messages like, oh, don't tell, you know,
yes.
Don't tell tales. And mm-hmm. So some, you know, some teachers will actually actively encourage kids not to tell tales. So then it becomes really hard for a 5 year old to say, or a 4 year old to say, you know, so-and-so has been mean to me. Now, if so-and-so has been mean to you, that could be anything from they're pushing me around to they're saying mean things to they're not letting me play the game. And again, usually at that age, is once adults are actively involved so that they're observing what's going on, they're intervening where needed, you know, you resolve that kind of stuff pretty quickly. But a lot of it is about what the school can do, you know, and if possible, it might be even possible to bring in the Parents Association of the school into it.
Brilliant.
As well, because again, there might be some kind of parent stuff that you can do. So you get all the parents talking about it as well with their children at home, making sure that everybody's on the same page. But look, it's nice to play with everyone and we have to play nicely and we have to share, take turns, all that kind of stuff.
Thanks, David. I know that's a huge issue and you were touching it, but you talk about it with Ryan a lot when you're on, which is great because it is so important. But David Coleman, thank you so much for talking to me.
Pleasure.
Thank
Exhausted.
You.